everyone. I'm Allison Goldstein, and I'm presenting with Wesley Eplin here. We are from an organization based in Chicago called Radical Public Health. Okay. And we're here today to provide a political framework and to talk about how we're living in a state of public health, or prison nation, which makes our goal of health equity impossible. We are definitely not getting paid to say any of this. So our goals for this presentation are to define the prison nation, and that's a term that we borrow from Beth Ritchie, whose book Arrested Justice, if you haven't read it already, you should check it out. Then we will provide a brief historical political background, and we will discuss some of the inequities that are created and exacerbated by mass incarceration. Finally, we want to talk about what we can do about it. So mass incarceration is defined by comparatively and historically high or extreme rates of incarceration. Where you see the beginning of this exponential growth also marks the beginning of the war on drugs in 1971. The majority of people who have been incarcerated since 1970 were for nonviolent drug offenses. In a just society, it would be reasonable to expect that the racial makeup of the U.S. prison population would reflect the racial makeup of our general population. As this chart demonstrates, that is clearly not the case. African Americans are incarcerated at nearly 6 times the rates of whites. And while the drastic increase in incarceration began at the same time as the war on drugs, the racial makeup of the U.S. prison population is also grossly misrepresentative of the racial makeup of drug users in this country. So we really have to question, what is the true purpose of this war on drugs? So what are we to make of this inequity? Well, it's called racism. The war on drugs is targeting and disproportionately impacting communities of color. So much so that a black male born in the U.S. today can expect to be incarcerated by age 14 and live 5 to 10 years less than his white counterpart. Blacks and minorities are 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites who are arrested for the same offense. And if this really is a war on drugs, it is having no discernible impact on drug use over time. So in this era of austerity and evidence-based policy, why are we not cutting spending on this clearly ineffective war, among others? So how did we get here? Let's take a look at what else has been going on. In 1970, the U.S. prison population was less than 250,000. Now, in 2013, it's more than 2.5 million. And while the prison population has been rapidly increasing, crime rates have actually been decreasing or have plateaued, which means that the need for incarceration has not been increasing. Is it also a coincidence that the number of Americans in poverty has doubled in the same time period? Now 1 in 2 American families can be considered working poor or near poverty. So what are we to make of this? We are not the first to conclude that mass incarceration is a direct result of neoliberal policies, but we think it is worth mentioning here at this National Conference of Public Health Professionals. We need to start talking more explicitly about the role of neoliberal policies in creating the vast inequities in public health that we see today. So let's take a closer look at the ideology behind the economic and punitive neoliberal policies of the past few decades and their impacts. Neoliberal economic policy is all about privatization of public services, shifting resources away from welfare programs and limiting government intervention in social and healthcare outcomes of the poor. The emphasis is on personal responsibility. Poverty and poor health are results of bad decisions. So what happens is the poor are required to work at low-wage, low-skilled jobs with little or no benefits, which locks them into poverty by preventing them from accessing education and other opportunities for upward mobility. Meanwhile, significant cuts to social services complement significant tax cuts for the rich, resulting in a reverse redistribution of wealth. Compared to other industrialized countries, we know that the U.S. has the worst health outcomes. But here we can see that countries with better health outcomes spend more on welfare and have lower imprisonment rates. There's actually a strong inverse correlation between welfare spending and incarceration rates. This chart shows the international numbers, but the same relationship has been observed at the state level in the U.S. as well. Now let's take a look at the punitive neoliberal policies. While economic policies invest fewer resources in the most disadvantaged populations, punitive policies do the opposite, but with similar results. Punitive neoliberal policies are targeted at people with the least money, power, and resources. They are considerably more lenient on white-collar crimes. So the result is increased pronouncement of incarceration along lines of race and class. Now that we understand a bit of the historical political context of mass incarceration, let us reconsider what is the true purpose of the war on drugs.
Hi, everyone. Again, I'm Wesley Eplin, and I'm a health policy analyst in Chicago. So I think we've probably heard enough. A racist, classist system. Let's burn it down to the ground. Well, that's sufficient reason enough for me. There's more to this. The war on drugs works. The war on drugs works in the sense that it has formed what has been called a social container for disempowered people who it locks up into an undercast. Not only is incarceration ineffective at helping people, not only is it costly, but also locking people up and then locking them out of social, economic, and political structures is very bad for their health and well-being. So let's transition a bit now and talk a little bit about the social determinants of health as a useful framework to talk about incarceration. Let's focus on the importance of money, power, and resources inequities, which the war on drugs worsens for individuals, families, and communities, and indeed within our entire society. So this is from Healthy People 2020. One of our four overarching goals is to achieve health equity, eliminate disparities, and improve the health of all groups. It's a public declaration of goals for public health by our own government via the Centers for Disease Control. This is the public health approach to public policy. I'll challenge you to think about this question. How does our field's inability to assert and stipulate an equitable, just way to deal with drug use compare with this commitment to health equity? So incarceration worsens and perpetuates disparities. It worsens the health of disadvantaged groups and precludes achievement of health equity. The war on drugs has been very effective at controlling people targeted by the war on drugs. Let's be specific. It targets low-income people with low educational attainment and in mostly Black and Latino communities. It worsens inequities in money, power, and resources, which makes achieving health equity within the U.S. an impossibility while the war on drugs continues. It's important for us in public health to never sugarcoat the situation. This is the public health approach to public policy and practice. So what is public health? Public health is a group of policies, practices, and attitudes that are hostile to people's health and well-being. The more I've researched this topic, the more disgusted I have become, both with this reality and the deafening silence that encapsulates it. Public hell is the most apt phrase I have found for the structural, physical, and psychological violence. Implemented with tens of billions of public dollars each year, with relatively broad public indifference to the depth of this problem. Mass incarceration is not alone as a set of policies and practices that are unjust. We don't have time to go through all of these, but the broad context of policies that are structurally, physically, and psychologically violent is quite long. These policies serve the self-interest of a few at the expense of many, and ultimately they are destructive to our entire society. So how does mass incarceration worsen inequities of money, power, and resources? It's worthwhile to note that it does so at different stages in the life course, and that mass incarceration impacts not just the individuals, but their families, communities, and society more broadly. Again, think about health equity and the social determinants of health framework being applied to the life course of those who face this oppression, looking broadly at the overlapping impacts of the system. So before incarceration is a stage where we talk about people who are targeted by the war on drugs, but before they're ever in the system. According to Becky Pettit and Bruce Western, state prisoners average just a 10th grade education. About 70% have no high school diploma. 40% of inmates are illiterate, and 67% didn't have full-time jobs prior to arrests, which is a barrier to effective legal representation, among many other things. Excuse me. So the foster care to prison pipeline is where kids have parents who are incarcerated, and kids who have parents who are incarcerated are five times more likely to eventually have criminal justice system involvement. Stop and frisk, minorities are disproportionately impacted by this policy. It begs the question, why is our association giving an award to Michael Bloomberg, the stop and frisk mayor? I think this is indicative of the levels of ignorance and indifference about racial profiling within our own field, and something we have to address. The school-to-prison pipeline introduces children to the criminal justice system at a young age, and it prioritizes policing over what used to be normal disciplinary matters within the school itself. It also reduces resources for teaching and for counseling by focusing on policing. During incarceration, people who are incarcerated obviously aren't earning a living out in the world. They're behind bars. So it's an interruption and delay of the transition from teenager to adult, as an employee, as a spouse, as a parent. The loss of earnings at a job is a significant impact on the individual as well as the family and community. Serving time in prison is associated with 40% reduction in earnings, reduced job tenure, reduced hourly wages, and higher unemployment. Violence and rape in the prison system is a crucial issue as well. An estimated 4.4% of prison inmates and 3.1% of jail inmates reported experiencing one or more incidents of sexual victimization by another inmate or facility staff member within the last 12 months. Related to voting, 48 states and the District of Columbia prohibit by law inmates from voting while incarcerated for a felony offense. That's not how other democracies deal with incarcerated individuals and voting. There's also a lack of adequate and appropriate health care and a lack of education in individual development while in prison. That's not to say that those don't exist at all, it's to say that they're insufficient. After incarceration. From a money perspective, people are often barred from many professional skilled and government jobs, lower wages for a lifetime, and legalized discrimination regarding employment. From a power perspective, again, voting rights reinstatement is difficult to impossible. The bureaucracy related to that is very difficult, especially if you're dealing with these other issues of not having a job or facing housing discrimination and the like. The resources discrimination includes public housing, loans for higher education, and other public benefits. Impacts on the families of the incarcerated. So there's the loss of an income earner within your own household, which has a huge impact on the amount of money within that family as well as within the community. There's the cost associated with keeping in touch, travel, time, phone calls, hotels, and the energy that it takes to do all of that. The separation of families, loved ones being separated from one another, parents being separated from their kids, divorce and separation. And if a relationship happens to survive the incarceration, there's the housing discrimination, which forces a tough choice between staying together and risking eviction or living separately. And again, the children of incarcerated parents are more likely to be criminal justice system involved. On the community, from a money perspective, reduced economic activity is an already under-resourced community. So you have communities that are already under-resourced and fewer people who are earning a living in that community. Voting discrimination related to convictions also impacts the community, and prison gerrymandering, which is reallocating resources, voting, and representation to mostly rural, mostly white populations. It's kind of a modern-day three-fifths compromise where whites are voting on behalf of blacks in their jurisdiction who don't get to vote. impacts power through reduced representation of the communities that have the reduced census, and also impacts their government appropriations. There's also the weakened social networks, which has an impact on people's ability to find jobs, reduce trust and connectivity in the community. So the predominant economic system, having produced these inequities, having reinforced inequities that persist from the historical racial inequities in the U.S., and extended impoverishment and marginalization, also has little need for as many low-income people with low educational attainment, as the country has deunionized, moved jobs overseas, and promoted a low-wage economy with insufficient jobs. The system then turns to neoliberal policies using the doctrine that the health and social problems with drug use are the fault of the individual, choosing to lock up and further disenfranchise these very people, most of whom are from low-income communities, most of whom have low education, and most of whom are Black or Latino. So inequities of money, power, and resources yield mass incarceration, and in turn, mass incarceration yields greater inequities of these, one of many self-perpetuating cycles of public health that preclude our achievement of health equity. So what can we do? This is an ongoing, decades-long public health crisis. So we need constant discourse on this issue and learning opportunities both inside and outside the classroom. We have to better understand this problem and discuss alternatives to it. We have to always be honest about this problem, its nature, and its depth. If we are unwilling to call this out as oppression, as a public health issue, as an injustice, and to fight to change it, then our commitment to our claimed value of social justice, our seriousness about the goal of achieving health equity, and the importance we actually place on the social determinants of health are all called into question. We need to also have a strong evidence base for both what's wrong with incarceration and what works to address the health and social problems related to drugs. We have to ask, why do public health policies and practices take precedence over public health promoting policies? And we need to engage with and learn from, as well as support and join those who are already working to change this, to find alternatives, and those working to dismantle the system. That includes academics, community partners, and activists. From a policy perspective, we have to help build up existing treatment alternatives, craft and promote policies that are helpful related to the social determinants of health and those impacted by incarceration, work to repeal harmful, oppressive policies and replace them with ones that equify money, power, and resources. We can learn a great deal from engaging with those who experience incarceration, their families, and communities. We also can and should work with the activists who are pushing back against public health policies and really join this fight for a humane, just way of dealing with drug use, abuse, and addiction. People have been researching and writing about this for a very long time. Of course, we want to alleviate immediate suffering, but we must keep our long-term goals in mind before we advocate for any incremental reforms. We have to be sure that if implemented, these reforms will bring us closer to abolition rather than reinforcing the current structures of oppression. And all of these minor reforms only tinker with the current reality. In order to achieve real systemic change, we're going to need to engage in a mass movement. We need to place any given small effort, it's a large system, so dismantling it may come slowly inside the broader fight. This system of locking people up for drug abuse and addiction has got to go, and we can't ever let on that anything less is acceptable. Small wins count along the way, but we need a radically different way of addressing drug use, abuse, and addiction, and to put an end to this public hell as a means to move toward achieving health equity.
Thank you, Wesley and Allison. Such a very powerful message. It's so very true. It seems almost just, it is crazy that we do lock people up that are victims of being drug abusers. You know, that's a mental condition. And we throw you in jail as a means of what? And then you come out and you're even worse off than you were before you went in. So, yeah, we got to do something about it.
Well, what I'm going to talk about this morning will not take very long because the research base, the knowledge base about the relationship of these two very important phenomena is quite limited at this point in time. But I would like to put it in the context of other ongoing research that I participated in. Work that I've done together with many colleagues and others working in this field over the last 20 years has taken us away from the old concept of socioeconomic explaining all differences in racial rates of infant mortality and other health outcomes. We've learned that, in fact, the conditions of life impact directly on various functions of the body and in health, everything from hypertension to diabetes to cancer risk, and I would also add preterm birth and infant mortality. This is probably related to chronic, long-term stressors rather than acute things that happen during the course of pregnancy. And once you have that conceptual framework, how can incarceration, whether it's the mother handcuffed to her bed during labor or the father who's been taken out of the family and the community, how can these not be major stressors that impact on health? A key protective factor in any stressed situation is social support, which is obviously difficult to maintain when your support person is behind bars. A study that we conducted some years ago, an interview study of African-American women giving birth in Chicago, compared women who gave birth to premature babies under 1.5 kilograms to those who gave birth to full-term babies. The best-known findings from that study are that perceived racial discrimination doubles, or if there's enough of these domains involved, triples the risk of a preterm birth for an African-American woman. But also another important finding from that same study was when we asked women if they had a support person present with them, whether it was the father or their mother or some other loved one with them in the delivery room, those who did not had an over 3 times increased risk of ending up with a preterm baby. Moreover, in asking this sample of 312 African-American women in Chicago if they had anyone in their close circle, immediate family incarcerated, fully 16% answered that this was, in fact, their case. So this is not a rare risk factor. A study which is ongoing, or is being written up at this time, utilized our transgenerational birth file that allows us to know the life course economic environment of women. We controlled for that, as well as their educational attainment, smoking, and a variety of other covariates, and looked at the difference between women who are married, those who are not married but name the father on their birth certificate, and those who do not name the father, and found that at each level of separation between mother and father, there is a significant increase in additional risk, even after controlling for all other covariates. So, this brings us to the question of direct impact on infants and children. Despite a fairly large literature on social inequality from incarceration, very little has been written about the children. But how can this not be an important area for study, where 25% of African-American children will experience an incarcerated parent, and 3% of white children, which, although drastically lower, is huge compared to the rest of the world? Thanks to my colleague, Dr. Patterson, who will be presenting next, I was steered towards some groundbreaking work by Chris Wildeman, who published, to my knowledge, the only really solid study to date looking at the approach, looking at the impact, rather, of parental incarceration on infant mortality. These different types of data, birth outcomes and incarceration, are not linked. It's not on the birth certificate. However, using the PRAM survey, Dr. Wildeman was able to make some very important observations. The PRAM survey which is data collected directly by survey from some thousands of women, different numbers in different states, assembled by the CDC. And for this particular study, used a period of 14 years between 1990 and 2003. The PRAMS data, as many people who worked with this may already know, after numerous callbacks and so forth, manages to achieve a 75% response rate, which is pretty acceptable for a population-based questionnaire study. Of the 57,000 some odd births, they recorded 273 deaths, which is probably an underreporting. Nevertheless, it's instructive. They limited their study, Chris Wildeman limited his study to the less educated women because this is where the risk factor of incarceration was concentrated. And he controlled for a number of important covariates in his logistic models. So what he found was that, first of all, the technique in terms of age of survey was about the same between the parent incarcerated group and the not incarcerated group. Marital status, race, the experience of stressful events during the pregnancy, and smoking were all different between the incarcerated and not incarcerated group. Perhaps even more striking was domestic violence, which was more than or approximately three times as common in the apparent incarcerated group. Oddly, low birth weight was not nearly as high as one might expect, since that's the usual pathway by which we get from stress risk factors to infant mortality. Nevertheless, it's interesting that the raw odds ratio for having either parent incarcerated was 1.58. And after controlling for demographic, prior preterm, use of the WIC program, stressful events, smoking, and preterm birth, the odds ratio had changed very little, still approximately 1.5. It does turn out that reporting domestic abuse is very important. It turns out that in families where there has been no reported abuse, the incarcerated risk is much higher. So it doubles the risk of infant mortality in those families. So from this very first groundbreaking study, what we can say already is that incarceration is a strong independent risk factor with a 50 to 100% increase in the risk of mortality. The effect is modified by the presence of domestic abuse in the family in question. There are some serious questions and limitations, the mortality undercount, the lack of demonstrated low birth weight as a mediating variable, and so forth. There's a lot of work to be done here, in other words, but these are not data to be dismissed. Chris also did a population analysis where each state was a case, and he compared infant mortality rates by incarceration rate and then controlled for a variety of covariates. And this essentially backed up the individual level data. Statistically significant and strong association of infant mortality rate with incarceration. The incarceration effect was twice as high in states that have a significant black population. And furthermore, state incarceration rates are correlated with the black-white infant mortality rate difference. More people behind bars, bigger racial gap in infant mortality. So from this preliminary work, early but still very important, I would conclude that incarceration is similar to many of the other stressful social factors that we've looked at. In the United States, we're pretty stressed. And secondly, we're not stressed at the same rate. There's a huge racial disparity that is reflected in health differences. Incarceration is also different from some of the other factors we've tried to study. One of the main ones from the researcher's perspective is that the data are not provided in the same files, and so a lot of creative work is going to have to be done to figure out how to bring these two forms of information together to study it adequately. So I would just say that there's much epidemiology that still needs to be clarified, but I would like to echo the previous speaker in saying that we have here a social justice issue. Even if we did not have demonstrated effect on mortality of locking up half the population, it would still be wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. David. Very well said. Our next speaker is Dr. Evelyn Patterson.
Good afternoon. This is a really lively crowd. I'm not used to this at conferences. That's not to say anything bad about any of the other conferences that I've gone to, but is there like a large Chicago tendency here? Right. Just checking. I will introduce myself very briefly. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Vanderbilt University, and I had a very interesting email in exchange between Dr. It's hard because you have two first names. Dr. David? David, okay. Okay. So, Dr. David. And then I said, you know what? I don't know. Maybe I should just come to the meetings. It might be fun. And thus far, I've had a lot of fun. I want to start by sort of echoing some of the sentiments of the prior presenters. So first of all, let me say that my father grew up in Chicago. So most of that family is there, so I'm sort of Chicagoan, too. I like the pizza, the deep dish. And as a child, one of the things that my father's a man of very few words. When I get words from him, it's pretty significant. But one statement that he's repeated over and over throughout the course of my life has been that it takes a generation of sacrifice for change to occur. And that's what I think of when I think of this issue of mass incarceration. For him, when he was growing up, he was a Black Panther. And he sort of stopped doing that after a while, but he was involved in lots of other, I guess, community-specific things that were meant to enrich the people in his community and just all people. And that's sort of the sentiment that I feel with this, and something that I'm proud that I was exposed to as the child of my parents. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the work that I've done in this area, just briefly talk about three different studies, and hopefully I will get the big cheers too. I don't know. All right. So just as a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about, which you really don't need that much, but factors related to health outcomes, which I'm guessing that most people in this audience probably already know. The bigger studies that I've done are related to mortality and the impact of prison. And then lastly, I'll talk a little bit about a life course perspective of incarceration and inequities that we see in life expectancy. I might talk about the future of health and incarceration, but I'm not sure yet. So just in terms of mortality and morbidity, we know that these things increase with age, that they differ by sex, by gender. People who are racial minorities tend to have poorer health outcomes. And we tend to see that people who have higher socioeconomic status have better health outcomes, and that is a very complex process which has been measured in many different ways that sometimes give us results that look like, oh, if we just made this a little bit better, then everything would be equal. I'm certainly not someone who actually believes that given the models that people actually do, but I'm going to do my best not to go too much into any jargon of my discipline. So I'm just going to try to stick to the key findings. So one of the studies that I've done looks at mortality inside prisons versus outside prisons. And it's been interpreted in many different ways, so I'll actually, I guess, have a chance to tell you my own interpretation. Now, as Dr. David said before, people who study this have a very tough time because the actual measures of health are very different than the data sets that include information on the people who have been incarcerated. So this is actually a piece of my dissertation, and this little graph here made use of about 40 or so different data sets. Okay. Here I'm looking at the ratio of years of life lost in prison compared to the United States, and I'm looking within a specific age range, people who are aged 18 through 65, which is what we sort of think of as working years. Now, with life expectancy, we know life expectancy in the U.S. is around 79-ish, and what I'm looking at is sort of the complement of that. How many years on average does one actually lose between the years 18 and 65? So you could possibly live 47 years, but if we take into account that there are differences and people do actually die, people on average, we lose. So in this particular graph, I'm showing the ratio of the years of life lost in prison to the United States. Now, this one, that means that everything is equal. If the bars are higher, then that means that the years of life lost in prison are greater than that lost outside of prison. If they are lower, then that means that actually the mortality in general in prison is lower than it is outside of prison. So you see for most groups, except for men right here, that prison is quite detrimental. But then you see this weird thing going on with black men, and you have to say, what's going on? It's like a song, right? What's going on? There we go. And so this is something that I didn't expect to find, but I did find it. And so one of the things that people have proposed in the past is something that I like to call the safety hypothesis. And that's a hypothesis that says, well, here we are, we've actually imprisoned people and we're helping them out. They're not able to shoot guns and do this. And so it's actually safer for them to be in prison. And there's a way to test that, which I did test, and that's actually not what's going on. I call it debunking the safety hypothesis. What you'll see in this next slide is actually me looking at the age-specific mortality rates of black men and white men between the period that I just showed you before on the graph. So if you look at black men, this line that's above, their mortality in the U.S. population is always higher than that in state correctional facilities. At every single age, the age-specific rate is actually higher outside. And what's important to notice is this big gap here and then this widening gap here. If we look at just white men and black men who are not in prison, okay, then we see that there is a constant difference going on in terms of their age-specific mortality rates, where white men always have significantly lower age-specific death rates than black men. Okay? So, two things we know. Black men are pretty bad off. But if we look at age-specific death rates of white men between the U.S. population and the state prison population, there's actually not any age-specific, significant age-specific death rate differences going on. And this last one is the kicker. So this is looking at white and black men who are actually in prison. Should we be running? Sorry. You said burn, Wesley. Sorry. And there's actually no significant difference between the age-specific death rates of white men in prison and black men in prison. So what does this mean? Well, it actually turns out to mean that black men in prison have the same age-specific death rates, or at least there's no significant difference between the age-specific death rates of black men in prison and white men outside. Now, this calls into question lots of research. I mean, we talk about what's happening in childhood and the long arm of childhood health and how it impacts people so much that, well, why should we even try? Why should we even try to help people when they're older? We focus on kids a lot. But this here says something completely different. It says that even though it's like this outside, it's like this inside. Now, the mean length of stay during this period of study was 2.262 years. So I really am the number of person who can't help but go out three decimal points, 2.262 years. So that means in a relatively short amount of time, somehow we have reduced this to this. No significant differences. And so to me, what that says is that even in a hostile environment such as prison, that it is possible to reduce health disparities. And this is not to say that I believe that prison health care is great. I do not believe that. And it's also not to say that, I don't know, any other sort of weird thing that people have said that I've said, even though I haven't. But rather that in prison, you actually do have something. So that means that if you have a chronic illness, then it's a chronic illness that you could get medication for. So instead of dying from that chronic illness, which is probably what we're seeing around here, you don't. Now, once you leave, well, that's sort of bad. But you don't die. And so what the study does for me is it really challenges, it just really challenges us to really think about, well, actually we have a lot more power than we think we have, and there are ways that we can actually reduce disparities in a short period of time. The other thing that it does, or at least it communicated to me, is that what kind of hell is this? That prison actually looks better. What kind of hell are we creating where prison looks good? So that's inside prison. But I've also looked at post-prison mortality. And I've done it in a different way than most people have. One of the issues that comes up with post-prison mortality is selectivity. People say, well, you know, prisoners are actually different from other people. And I say, maybe that's true. They did get caught. And that's really all that's different. They got caught. All right. Not only did they get caught, then they also got convicted and all these other things happened. So, yeah, okay, maybe they're different. But let's be real. We've all committed crimes. We just didn't get caught. All right. I mean, I didn't jaywalk, but I have jaywalked peer pressure. Okay. In this particular study, I was looking at parolees. So all of them had some experience of incarceration. And I was interested in what was the relationship between the length of time someone spends in prison and their life expectancy post-prison. Okay. Now, when I first submitted this paper to the American Journal of Public Health, very highly esteemed, right? Everybody has to, like, say that, right? Okay. All right. The initial title was actually something quite different, which you'll see on the next slide. And I was encouraged to change the title because it was too political. But I think that the findings of this study sort of say that. Every year in prison is associated with 2 years of loss in life expectancy. Okay? Every year that a person spends in prison is associated with 2 years of their life expectancy declining. So here in this table, I've got the length of stay in months. So at this 12-month mark, or 1 year, it's about 2 years. I've also got this column called time to recovery. And that's how long it takes for a person to actually return back to the normal mortality curve. And so one of the questions is, okay, well, does this penalty diminish over time? Because I've got time to recover. And I'd argue that I'm going to say no. I'm going to say what this column actually reflects is the selectivity in the population. People who are able to actually survive post-prison are people who have families who have resources. And when I say resources, I mean money and social support. Okay? Most people, unfortunately, do not have those things, and there are risks that their family take on. Thank you, again, Wesley, for talking about that, so I don't need to. That would actually make it sort of a question, oh, well, should we do this, or are we putting our family at risk? So I'd say that these people who actually recover are a minority. The other thing is that death as a collateral consequence of incarceration or an unintended consequence is very different from others. So we've talked about the right to vote, and actually there have been some great advocates out there, such as Mark Maurer, who have actually made it such that states have reversed limiting voting on people who have felony records. But we can't bring people back to life yet, to my knowledge. I'm not a doctor, and I'm not an MD, medical doctor. So this is why I believe that this is something that we should look at a lot more closely, because to me it really is a hidden death penalty. Have I depressed you enough yet? I've got no more. The thing that brought me to this area of study was thinking about it in terms of the life course. When I was in grad school, I was actually much more about sexually transmitted infections and working with the CDC. That's my lifelong goal. I wanted to be at the CDC. But during that time, I started to notice certain conversations. And one of the conversations that I picked up on from my fellow colleagues was, well, you know, 2 years in prison, it's the same thing as 5 years. And it's a little disheartening. Actually, it was very disheartening to me to think that people could actually think that 2 years is the same thing as 5 years, or that no time, which is what most of these people were speaking from, is different than spending time in jail, being arrested, being profiled, prison versus jail, not even knowing the difference. Those were things that I thought needed to have some sort of context. And I thought that if I could just provide the duration that people can expect to spend in these life states, where you can only be in a life state of free, well, initially. If you ever leave the life state of free, you cannot return to the life state of free. Now, you can go to incarcerated, okay, and go to parole, you know, that can go back and forth. And you can go to this life state that I've called free, which means that you are unconditionally free, but you've been previously incarcerated. And as Wesley spoke about, there are lots of limitations, many of them quite legal, that are placed upon people who have felony convictions. Right? You can also die. Okay. So every state leads to death eventually, but the main thing being that once you are no longer free, you're something else. And that is how you are viewed in this society. So I conducted a study that took into account mortality and sort of estimated how much time can one expect to spend in each of these different life states during their working years. So this is an interestingly complicated table. So I wanted to just start with this. People at the age of 18 start out with that initial life state. They can start free, they can start out incarcerated, they can start paroled or free. This particular square that I'm showing you at this table is for people, African American men, who started out their adulthood free. Now they can stay free, or they can go to incarcerated, they can go to paroled, they can go to freed. Between ages 18 and 65, a person can live a total of 47 years. Okay. That's the maximum amount that you can live. What I'm showing you here are the cumulative number of years that an African-American male can expect to spend in the state of free, which is 34, incarcerated, which is 1.3, paroled 1.1, and freed 4.6, where it sums to 41. So 41 of those years, 41 out of 47 years I lived, and 1.3 on average, now we're talking on average, are incarcerated. And I'm not looking at people who are in jail. I'm not taking into account people who go to jail, only people in state correctional facilities. So people can also start incarcerated, paroled, or freed. And if we look at African-American men, we see that things change slightly. So if you start out free, you're looking at 41 years of life. Incarcerated, why is it higher? It is 41.3 years. Paroled 41.1, and freed 41.1. Okay. And here I'm actually looking at what proportion of those years are spent in these different life states. So it's roughly the same if you start out adulthood in any other state that's different than free. And this is the thing that takes into the inequities caused by actually being incarcerated. Now, if we look at white men, they can expect to spend about 43.1 years free, as long as they start adulthood free. And incarcerated, it's 0.2. And if I divide that, it's 0.00 something. Okay. And paroled is low and freed is low as well. However, when we get to these actual incarcerated states, they start to resemble quite a bit, at least on the proportion-wise. They look like African-American men. So race is a factor, yes, certainly, particularly when we're talking about starting out free. 1.3 versus 0.2 at the aggregate level. Nevertheless, once you are touched, and not touched in the good way, but touched by the criminal justice system, you're basically screwed. So, in terms of looking at the future of where my work goes, one of the things that people don't talk about a lot is women. And so I've done some work that looks at women health and incarceration in terms of morbidity and mortality also. I mean, this conversation is so important and so understudied that it leaves a vast amount of work to be done. And I am very happy and I feel very privileged to have been invited to speak at this session where there are people who actually care. So thank you.